Good evening, friends. Welcome. You'll be happy to know I have a watch with a timer, and I've set it to 55. I hope it's minutes and not hours. And I hope this evening does some level of justice to this topic. However, I better turn my timer on. My task has been made so much easier by the fact that we have all received the Rizvan message from the Universal House of Justice. This evening, what I'd like to do is to just share some observations. Of course, this is a document that we study, and it also provides a lens for us to look back at the 27th of December 2005 letter of the House of Justice, which is the framework, the blueprint for the plan. Then, in looking at the Rizvan message as a framework and as the benchmark for the progress that we've made thus far and where we now need to go, to look at some quantitative indicators of our achievements and our learning, and then, time permitting, to also look at some qualitative indicators that really come from the field in the form of the experience of the friends who are working at the grassroots. What I also hope to illustrate is the fact that we all play serving here at the World Centre, regardless of what job we do, we all play an integral and intimate role in ensuring that the heart of the faith continues to beat in a manner which ensures the flow of encouragement, of resources, and of guidance to the friends. To try and summarise, and that's the Rizvan message, or to reduce it to a number of points, is of course a very inadequate thing to do. So I first of all want to emphasise that any views that I express this evening is purely personal, except for the quantitative information. And also to suggest that all these are a few glimpses from this very rich message that the House of Justice has given us. A number of points that really relate in my mind to where we are at, in other words, what progress we've made thus far, are threaded throughout the document from the first paragraph to the last paragraph. In the first paragraph, the House of Justice refers to the fact that where the framework that it has clearly defined in the 27th of December message is working in a coherent manner, where all the elements have come together and are being pursued in an integrated manner, then growth is occurring. Both growth in terms of numerical growth in numbers, but growth in terms of the depth of community life, the level of spirit, and the quality, if you like, of the level of consecration in the community. We can see these examples, the House of Justice infers, both in clusters where there is a great deal of receptivity, where enrolments have not been in the past, nor are they now the main issue, and we are witnessing significant or large numbers, hundreds of believers coming into the faith. But unlike the past, where 100 would come in and 99 would drift away, we are now seeing that 100 come in and anything in the vicinity of 60 to 70% of those believers are engaging in the processes of the plan themselves. We are also witnessing the plan working successfully in clusters that the House talks about again in the 27th of December message, in referring to those type 2 clusters where the level of receptivity historically hasn't been there, where we need to focus on engaging the wider community in the core activities, but we also need to develop our capacity to teach and to accelerate the process of enrolments, the process of entry by troops. And we can witness this, for example, in a cluster like London, where for a number of cycles, through the processes, through systematic action, through increasing participation of the believers in the teaching work, they have experienced consistent numbers coming into the faith, small numbers coming into the faith in each cycle. Now that they've achieved that, they have set their eyes on upping that number, where initially perhaps two or three believers people might declare in each cycle, then the next stage is to sustain perhaps 10 believers, 10 new believers in each cycle. And we are seeing this occurring in a number of clusters in the developed world, which is certainly a sign that the plan is working effectively. I think I've touched on the second point, which is that the House of Justice describes in the second paragraph of its message that our main challenge is not so much, or has not so much been enrolments, but it has been our ability to act on belief. The ability of the friends who recognize, to those of us who recognize Baha'u'llah, to act on that belief in a way that reflects knowledge, spiritual insight, and the necessary skills. We are also learning, and I hope this will become evident to you, we are learning to analyze and then to act. We have engaged now in a process where there is continuity between the information that we interpret and the subsequent actions that we take. In other words, we are doing what the House has asked us, and to ensure that analysis informs our decision making. Related to this, and this has led us to a position where we build on strengths rather than think of things in terms of deficits. We identify what is working and where it is working, and then we endeavour to apply that. Of course, that doesn't mean there aren't obstacles that we need to remove. Where the framework is working coherently, the characteristics of the believers are resolute and systematic learning. And again, in the few examples that I'd like to refer to this evening, I think we'll see these characteristics of the resolve of the friends and their systematic endeavours to advance the plan. Another point that this message makes, which is particularly significant and characteristic of the first year of this current five-year plan, and the House used the word twice, and that is the word everywhere, that the plan has relevance throughout the community, throughout every single Baha'i community, in every single cluster, whether it be at an advanced stage of growth or at the earliest stages of growth. And the House of Justice describes how these the framework and the elements of the plan are resulting in growth at all levels of the community. We are also assured in this message that the foundation is now established. And essentially, as the House called to us at the beginning of the plan, all we now need do to is exploit it, not to question it, not to doubt it, not to prove it, whether it's right or wrong, but to exploit it. And then finally, the House of Justice in this message calls us, having established this foundation, having identified the means by which we can ensure that faith leads to action, is to do one thing, and that is to teach. But they also remind us, the House of Justice also reminds us, that it will be necessary for us to be unified in our action. And the House expresses the hope that the intensity of the unity, the strength of the unity of our community, will be such that it will stimulate every believer into action and into the teaching work. Friends, now some indications from a quantitative point of view. We are familiar with the term, the first movement, which of course refers to the movement of believers and seekers through the sequence of courses. And this, of course, includes the adults going through the main sequence and youth going through the main sequence, junior youth going through the core materials, and children progressing towards that destiny as well. And we can see from these statistics, and believe it or not, this represents a pyramid which has been turned upside down, because the top line, which you would expect, shows you the number through course one. And as you can see, that the number of people, participants, who have entered the sequence of courses has risen to over 250,000 globally. The blue line, vertical line there, represents the transition between the previous five-year plan and now the first year of this plan. And really what tells us, if we quickly glimpse at that, is that at all levels of the sequence, we are progressing in a steady manner. And this is what the House calls us, and refers again in the Rizvan message to the import, to the characteristics of a cluster that is growing, regardless of its stage, even a cluster that's got, 100 people who've completed the sequence, is to maintain that focus on the Institute. And wherever you see the first movement in a vital condition, then the second movement, which is the multiplication of core activities and the teaching work, is in a healthy condition. So we are learning that to focus on this in both a quantitative and qualitative manner, this first movement, is an essential and essentially takes care of the second movement. You can see one slight, it's not an anomaly, but you'll see these progress in sequence from 1 to 7, other than, of course, book 5, because book 5, as we know, was only introduced, junior youth as a core activity, and book 5, which is still in development stage, but already look at the significant advancement in the numbers going through book 5. So the second movement. We can look at this in terms of the core activities. Again, the blue line separates, or there's a transition between the two plans. You can see the significant progress from the beginning of the first plan, where the first five-year plan, we had 10,000 engaged in the core activities, and now that has reached a figure of 45,000, broken down into those areas of junior youth, children's classes, devotional meetings, and study circles. But what you'll notice is a reasonably sharp upsurge in the number of core activities. And these are, by the way, these are numbers of activities rather than number of people involved in them in this first year of the plan. That's a very encouraging indicator. Of course, when we talk about growth, then we're talking about outreach, and so it's relevant for us to assess, without making too sharp a distinction, the number of seekers who are engaged in the core activities. And this is the number of seekers rising from perhaps a few thousand, the beginning of the previous five-year plan, reaching in the vicinity of 115 by the end of the last five-year plan, and now climbing quite steeply to in the vicinity of 130,000. Again, a very encouraging trend and an indication that we are learning to reach out more effectively and in larger numbers. Of course, the House has given us a very concrete goal in achieving no fewer than 1,500 intensive programs of growth by Rizwan 2011. So how are we doing in that regard? You can look at it on a continental basis. The current total, as of the teaching centres count on Thursday, where we had a number of, in this last week, we've had something like 11, heard news of something like 11 clusters launching intensive programs of growth. We can see that the number is in the vicinity of 350 out of the ultimate goal of 1,500. The blue represents where we were at the beginning of this plan, and the yellow, and there's another colour there, but I'm colourblind, so the yellow represents the progress that we've made in the year to date. And you can see continentally the relative proportion of this goal that each continent has. And of course, we also need to look at enrolments as an indicator. Those who declare, who at a point in a process of approaching Baha'u'llah have been assisted or have themselves of their own volition or in spite of us declared their belief in Baha'u'llah. What you see on the left is the average per annum number of enrolments that we experienced during the previous five-year plan. So that's per year. It was in the vicinity of 25,000. We can witness in the first year of this plan, and this is a conservative estimate. It was based because we only have the figures till October last year, and so we've simply simply estimated it by doubling that number, which the experience of the last couple of months tells us is probably a very conservative way to approach it. But nevertheless, we are still increasing in terms of enrolments in a manner which is not dramatic. What is dramatic, what is very dramatic, is the qualitative nature of these enrolments. And we see, and we are virtually inundated at the teaching centre with stories of successes in teaching, including successes by new believers who know nothing else, who have no hang-ups, if you like, to leave behind, because they are immersed in a process, the heart of which is teaching, the heart of which are acquiring insights and skills to carry that out. So the qualitative difference of this cohort of new believers, if you compared it with the cohort of new believers from the mass teaching successes of the 70s and the 80s, there would literally be no comparison. You can also see, because the bands represent continental contributions to the number of enrollments, you can see whereas Africa and the Americas have increased significantly in the number of enrollments, Asia remaining roughly the same, there has been a significant decline in Australasia and Europe. Now this may look dramatic, but it can actually be traced to a number, for example, in Australasia, to a number of priority clusters there that were experiencing significant growth, that have been distracted by other things, social economic development at a premature stage and other developments, and this has had a dramatic impact on the enrollments. So even from the apparent pitfalls, we can learn how we need to refocus. In terms of cluster development, this gives you an indication. Now, the blue representing where we were at the end of the last plan, and the yellow or green representing where we are at now, it gives you an indication, first of all, that we've had an increase in the number of A's, or number of clusters that have established intensive programs of growth. What we haven't realized, and that means that those from the B blue column obviously went into the A column, but what we haven't witnessed significantly is an increase in the number of clusters that are at the stage of readiness for growth that category B describes. And therefore, this highlights that in the first 12 months of the plan, we've not only focused on that movement from B to A, but there is an intensive focus in the community on also moving those clusters at an earlier stage, a much earlier stage, and both in terms of numerical strength, needing, in fact, to experience growth before they reach a stage of being able to sustain intensive growth. But this also doesn't tell all the story. This is suggested by this pattern that suggests that what we need to look for and what we are finding is the movement within, for example, a cohort of C clusters. They're not static entities, they're not static constructs, but where they are vibrant, where things are moving forward, we can see the progress that the faith is making. The other thing, and this is of profound importance to this, that the last 12 months has confirmed, I guess confirmed what the House of Justice has been telling us since 1996, is that the foundation of this growth, the foundation of the movement of clusters, needs to be not only in training, but in carrying out the practices associated with the training, and then translating that into teaching work. Now, that might be, as the Rizvan message says, it might be teaching through conducting home visits, conducting firesides, inviting neighbours and friends to study circles. Whatever the manner, it needs to translate into practice. One particular approach, and you'll be familiar with the term refresher courses, that a number of the learning from the last year has shown us, is this concept of having a refresher course that, for example, looks at book two, looks at the key elements of book two that relate to home visits for the first half of the day or the first half of the weekend. And then the second half, there must have been 55 seconds. The second half, going out and having and making home visits. The term that has been coined and has been active refreshers, and I think in effect what we're finding, it is such a refreshment of the spirit and the soul. It may sound like a soft drink as an active refreshment, but the spiritual effervescence that results is extremely powerful. I'm not sure why that happened. Friends, I think there's so much quantitative information, and as I think you would perceive, that there is so much depth behind these indicators, which is not a surprise because they are the indicators of the framework and the activities that the voice of God on earth has focused us on. So we would expect it to be rich and challenging and very powerful. What I'm hoping to do now is to switch modes of presentation and to now this is where I do have a backup here. Roy is going to take over from me. So what to do? To view full screen. That's not as good as it should be, but at least it's working. I just wanted to try this evening to be unselfish and to share with you, as inadequately as that is possible to do, the amazing experiences of the members of the International Teaching Center who travel to and from the field of service and are enriched by these experiences. The particular aspect that I wanted to focus on was a series of 14 conferences of auxiliary board members that have just been completed and conducted. And as you can see, it's actually a very it's the most efficient way to increase momentum that I've seen. But friends, each of these conferences were attended by two or three members of the teaching center. And whenever we would come back, we would share the experiences. And what was apparent from these interaction with the 990 auxiliary board members around the world and the 81 members of the Continental Board of Counselors is that we are truly engaged in a process that is global in nature. The content that was prepared for the conference, which was centered around a number of case studies of relating to the processes of the plan, whether it was in Dallas, Texas, or in Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of Congo, in the middle of a war-torn zone, the same materials were used. And without exception, the auxiliary board members and the councillors said, "You've written about our clusters. This describes our clusters. This describes our experience. This describes our challenges." It was such a unifying, exhilarating experience, which really bears testimony to the the advice of the Guardian as long ago as 1951, when he was responding to the initiative of the National Spiritual Assembly of the United Kingdom to send pioneers into open territories in Africa. He described this as being the first of a number of phases that the faith would go through in the subsequent years, where national communities would undertake these enterprises. But then he said this was a prelude to global undertakings given to us by the Universal House of Justice that would unify our actions, unify the work of the faith throughout the world. And this is clearly what we are witnessing. I want to give you an insight to the reality of this plan as being a spiritual enterprise. And again, just by looking at a few anecdotes from these conferences. Oops. If you go to, and I need to confess a bias here, these are countries that I tend to work with. But this is in the heart of West Africa, Burkina Faso. The name of a cluster is, I actually can't pronounce it at this point in time, but I can usually pronounce this cluster, the name of this cluster. But this is one of the auxiliary board members, Maria. This was in an earlier visit last year to Burkina. Actually, before she was appointed as an auxiliary board member. But in this photo, she's expecting a child. And this child happened to be due to be born on the very date of the auxiliary board member conference in Accra, in Ghana, that she was to attend. So not to be deterred by this and being absolutely determined to get there, she arranged to have the baby delivered 2 weeks ahead of time. And with her, she brought the baby and her mother and didn't miss 1 minute of that conference. Such was, you know, such was the intensity of her spirit and her devotion. We can move to a conference now in DRC, in Kinshasa, that I referred to earlier. And that is the Congo River. On the north, as you look at it, is Brazzaville. On the other side is Kinshasa, two different cities in close proximity in two different countries. A significant number of the board members had to travel across that river, which at its widest distance there is 5 kilometers and at its shortest about 2 kilometers. And just what they endured to make that trip because of the corruption in society, it was almost impossible for them to make it. They were held up at 7 different official posts and had to pay bribes to make it through. But with their determination, what would have been a half-hour trip became an 8-hour trip, but their determination ensured that they got there. And just to give you another sense, these two auxiliary board members, the only means of transport they had to get to the conference was by foot. But this was walking day and night for 5 days in order to make it to the conference. So you have a sense. There were another two board members who attended this conference who paddled for 6 days, or were paddled for 6 days down the Congo River, only to arrive at a town where they were to catch the plane, and they had missed the plane by 2 hours. Undeterred, they pressed on and missed half the conference, but made sure that they got there. So you have a sense, friends, of the level of consecration amongst these believers who are and have been asked by the House of Justice to spearhead the work of the faith, which they are doing by their own example. Please bear with me. We now go to the Philippines, to the Metro Manila cluster, and I just want to show you a photograph which may look rather insignificant, but this is the culmination of the process of analysis that the House of Justice is calling us to do. These friends, and this is now becoming quite a common practice, particularly throughout Asia, are describing their human resources in terms of maps. And this is enabling them to work very strategically, ensuring that human resources are developed where they're needed, for example, where there is receptivity to the faith, or where there is a shortfall, an opportunity for children's classes that are not being met. They are thinking about this in a very strategic, a very creative, a very practical, simple, and effective manner. But this comes from this process of analysis, at the heart of which the World Centre operates, particularly because it is the flow of information that has come from the World Centre back to the World Centre from the grassroots that has enabled us to develop these processes of simple statistical analytical analysis, is there such a thing, and to make decisions based on that information. So there's not time to really go into depth into that other than to identify it as a very key learning. It was a very key focus of these auxiliary board member conferences that were held, whereby each and every auxiliary board member left those conferences with a concrete plan of action as to what they would do through their own example and by accompanying the friends in the field of service. And this is very much demonstrated by the example of this auxiliary board member. I can't not go to the Pacific. Mrs. Huck would never talk to me again. This is part of the Suva cluster. It's a small village, Nasinu. It's typical of this cluster, small villages dotted out through islands and islets. And this auxiliary board member who went back from the conference, the auxiliary board member conference in Auckland, with very concrete plans of action, has now written a report sharing these experiences. Now, this is very simple. For example, in this cluster, he identified a lack of children's class teachers. So he has gone around, he has organized, not necessarily done it himself, training in book three, but working closely and in visiting the friends in their homes and in encouraging them to do that. There are only two friends who completed the sequence in that cluster. So he's gathered five who've gone through a significant number of the books and is working with them to complete the sequence and then will assist them to start their own study circles and so forth. There are a number of, and the other area of focus is in book two and assisting the friends to carry out home visits. His report is very enchanting because throughout this report there's a thread, and this thread is his relationship with his wife, who herself is extremely busy with the work of the faith. But In this particular village, he said, I begged my wife that we could go and camp there for a couple of weeks so that we could carry out these activities. And then the end of his report talks about the fact that he said, I really need transport now, and I was consulting my wife on the possibility of foregoing our plan. to buy a car, to buy a house, and instead we'll buy a car because the urgency of the hour is so strong. I don't think he was talking about a Lamborghini, but possibly. Friends, how am I going? 14 minutes, it's okay. The House of Justice has placed a further emphasis on the education of children and junior youth. This is the country of Togo, a very, very poor country, again in West Africa. This child is from one of the children's classes and from one of the Baha'i communities. And I think, and this is a community where the processes of the plan are beginning to move, and certainly where children's classes are occurring in a systematic manner. And I think her face obviates the need for words to describe her experience. I would have liked to have spent much more time this evening on the importance of junior youth, because this has really been a highlight of the last 12 months. The work led around the world through the Office of Social and Economic Development has been not only profound in terms of the advancement of junior youth, but the lessons learned from the implementation of the junior youth program are now being applied to the implementation of the other core activities. But this young man characterizes it all. This was at a gathering in Lome cluster in Togo that coincided with the junior youth and children's classes, a gathering of the friends where we spent time using visual arts to explore and to express our relationship to Baha'u'llah and our relationship to the plan. And then each person or a number of people had an opportunity to express that. And this young man, who is not a Baha'i, he's not from a Baha'i family, but he and his brothers attend the children's class, he attends the junior youth group, turn up every weekend in their very best and cleanest attire. But the manner in which this boy expressed himself and his relationship to Baha'u'llah moved and inspired everyone to a point that I can't really do justice to. Suffice it to say that it really makes you begin to question, at what point is someone a Baha'i in this process? Is it just at a point where someone signs a card, or is that recognition of their heart something that we also need to recognize? Just to contrast and to remind us of what the children of the world are suffering, and as the House have called us in this RISMA message to the urgency of the hour, we can go to places all over the world and look at the suffering of people and the suffering of children. This caption reads, the girl with traumatized baby sister, the baby has not made a record, a sound since the day their parents were slaughtered and the village burned. And you can see, that's the village there, totally razed to the ground in Darfur. And friends, if we needed any further reminder, we can look into our own Baha'i community and go to, in this instance, Sierra Leone, where I'd like to talk just for a minute about these two children. These are two of over 350 students attending a Baha'i school in one of the clusters. 90% of that community identifies as Baha'is, the other 10% as Muslims, and there's wonderful harmony and integration. These children sing beautiful Baha'i songs. Their level of English is very good, but their depth of understanding about the faith is, and their parents, is almost negligible. And this is in a cluster, of course, in a country that has been at war for many years and has had many of the people from this village flee, only came back after 5 or 6 years of having to flee away. But it's a mass of humanity waiting and who can only be assisted by these processes of the plan that we're familiar with. So this is a contrasting situation of a cluster, an area full of the potential, but without the development of human resources, is not progressing, despite what on the surface might look wonderful. Several thousand believers who identify with the faith, but very little consecration and translation of that into service. So how's this being addressed? I want to now take you to back to Ghana. You can see where my bias is. but I want to take you to a neighborhood of Accra, Ghana, to the neighborhood adequately described as Auntie Beatrice's neighborhood. This is Auntie Beatrice Asari, who completed a number of terms of service as a member of the Board of Councillors at the end of 2005. And this is a description, a very skim description of what she has been doing since, or one of the many things she has been doing since. She lives in this area. She has identified a neighborhood around her home, and she has, and I need to show you because she is not someone obviously to be argued with. If you look closely at her dress, which is Baha'i faith pattern, she literally wears the faith on her sleeve. But she, in her own home, with her husband, Professor Asari, who's in a very frail physical condition, have themselves established a neighborhood class for the children in their neighborhood. The last time I spoke to her, there were in the vicinity of 60, 65 children coming on a regular, weekly, systematic basis. This children's class then was extended to the siblings, the older siblings, and a junior youth started. Again, junior youth group started for the friends, for the neighborhood. The interaction with the parents has now led to the parents coming into the home. The home is virtually an institute. So the parents coming into the home, starting with devotional meetings, now involving in study circles. So this model of focusing very much in the neighbourhood is another learning that we've had from this, particularly the last 12 months of the plan, but in the last couple of years of the previous plan. And is as if that wasn't enough, what Auntie Beatrice has now done, she has gone to two people, two believers who were receptive, who were attracted to what she was doing, and gone to their own neighbourhoods and assisted those believers to emulate this model and to replicate this model. So we can see essentially the principle of exponential growth really begins in the neighbourhood. A further example of this comes from the cluster that in fact was the very first cluster to establish an intensive program of growth, and that was Baku cluster in Azerbaijan. And there is a lot to learn from clusters that have now been through 9, 10, 11 cycles. Many of the learnings have come from obstacles. The initial couple of cycles, a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of success, and then a tendency, particularly where the focus on the first movement is lost, a tendency for that to wane. And this cluster was at a point where it was having just a handful of believers participate in the teaching teams, and the enrolments were literally in dribbles of one or two a cycle. And in the eighth cycle, prior to it, they took stock, they analysed things, and they identified the fact that one of the major problems was the fact that, if you imagine those, these are not actually people's homes, but it's pretty close to it, that they were forming their teams based on people who had friendships and common interests and so forth, but they were expending so much energy getting across the city, across the cluster, to come together that it just wasn't sustainable. So they took a conscious decision to change that model from, which is obvious, to one in which the teams were formed in neighbourhoods. And in many instances, they became teams of family members. And this totally changed the fortunes, both in terms of the numbers involved in the process of teaching, and then in that particular cycle, the eighth cycle, they had 19 declarations. The next cycle, they're having other challenges related to this. But you can see that it's a process, effectively, if you're familiar with the term, of action research. Acting, reflecting, and learning. Friends, the final area to focus on is, of course, teaching, as if we haven't touched on that. But in particular, I'd like to relate this to those clusters that are in, that the house described as the second type of cluster, where historically there hasn't been a great deal of receptivity and enrolments have been scarce. And what we are learning now is how to address this. And it's virtually through the work of the tutors, who see, who understand their vision as someone who is empowering the learning of others by translating the learning into action and assisting them to act. But beyond that, to also recognise their responsibility for assisting participants in the study circle to recognise Baha'u'llah. Mrs. Lincoln shared some very powerful stories from Luxembourg, and these are the only photos I could find of European people. But at least they're animated, I thought. Okay, sorry about this. So we have Luxembourg and Belgium, and these stories of descriptions from the tutors of how they approached the learning of the seekers as they went through the sequence of courses. This consciousness of the fact that they were working with a spiritual being, first of all. To pray constantly about that person and their spiritual development. One example was a tutor who said that when we did the section on prayer, I expected that the participants would be affected by the prayer. And so I acted on that. And that is when I was perhaps more assertive and more direct in my approach to teaching the faith. Another tutor mentioned that throughout the study circle, she threaded stories of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá, which touched the hearts of the seekers and built this love for the central figures as they went through the course. Another tutor, when the participants completed book one, she posed the questions at the end of the book one, to everyone, Baha'is and seekers. Questions that challenge people by saying, now that you've recognized that this life continues beyond, you're living a spiritual existence, what is it that you wish to do to serve humanity? Now that you've reached this point, you have connected with Baha'u'llah, what is your relationship to his covenant? And without exception, yes, there were believers, seekers, who did not declare as a result of that, but there were a significant number of these seekers who, as a result of that invitation to become a Baha'i, presented in a very, more than skillful, a very spiritual manner, recognize their faith in Baha'u'llah. Another tutor sent invitations to participants to come to a fireside, and she said that, I feel that you are very close to recognizing Baha'u'llah, and that's why I'm inviting you. And most of these seekers responded by saying they felt honored to have been invited, and two or three of those seekers declared. So really, in a very conservative, in countries where we haven't seen growth, let alone in the 70s, virtually at all, to any significant extent, we are now witnessing these processes that the House has given us coming into effect. And finally, I'm conscious that I overlooked the United States or the Americas, so not to be outdone, I'm taking you right to Roya Furughi's home. And that's actually her home. And I figured by the number of cars in the driveway, there's definitely a study circle going on. But friend, there is one other teaching story that is there is one other teaching story that I'd like to end with, which also highlights the receptivity of people who we may otherwise feel, you know, they're not interested, they're preoccupied with their life and their other forms of service to humanity. This comes from Ulaanbaatar, the auxiliary board member there, who was simply asked by a colleague to teach the faith to a medical practitioner. This practitioner happened to be the Secretary of State to the Minister for Health in Mongolia, and also operated a medical training college for 800 students. She went to the home of this doctor and her husband and with the encouragement of her friend, talked the faith in a very direct manner. The response of the doctor was to say, "This is wonderful. I need you to come to my college, not to teach the faith, but I need you to come and to carry out a moral development program for the students, because this is something lacking in the course for doctors in this country." Her response was to say, "Look, I'm sorry, I don't have any moral development materials as such, but what I do have is this material called Reflections on the Life of the Spirit, Book One." The doctor said, "Fine, but first of all, take me through it. Take me through that material." So every night for a number of weeks, this doctor was extremely busy. This board member is a professional person herself, very busy. She would go to the clinic, to the facility at 9 o'clock at night, and they'd spend 1 hour. And almost from the outset, this doctor recognized the truth of the writings and constantly referred to her belief in Baha'u'llah and recognized the faith. She was so enamored by it that every night they had to conduct a study circle, the two people, in a different room of the college, because the doctor said these divine fragrances have to go right throughout this this facility. The doctor then said to the board member, "Okay, now come and conduct it with the students." And the last time we spoke, she was sharing with us that she'd conducted the first sections of Book One with three groups of students, averaging 60 at a time. So she was working with 180 students, an average of 60 in each of her study circles, of course realizes that that's not sustainable, and had then concluded, well, the only way is to develop tutors and take a core group through the sequence so that they can be a self-sustaining community. The doctor, because of her associations nationally, invited the board member to a national conference of 35 doctors, asked her to speak about this process of study circles, and as a result, five or six of those doctors are now going through Book One, and a significant number of their children and their older children are engaged in study circles and junior youth groups. So friends, we can see that these preconceived notions that we might have, and it's really interesting to read her reflections, the learning that she had, because it totally dispelled her preconceived notions that these medical practitioners and students would not have time for spiritual issues. So we now go right to the heart of where all this begins and where it continues to flow from, and that, of course, is the Holy Land, to the most sacred spot on the planet, Baji, to the center of our faith, the administrative and spiritual center of our faith, if it'll go there, which is connected, of course. And this is where we are all working. This is where we all have the privilege to be part of this pulse, to be the instigation of this pulse that is rejuvenating and spiritualizing spiritualizing the planet. And finally, of course, it is with the guidance and our adherence and our obedience to the Supreme Body, the Universal House of Justice, that we are ensured of the success of this unfailing path, aloha path.